Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
In the mid-1980s, Steve Ackley took an interest in religion, in good versus evil and morality stories. Harry Stephen Ackley is a graduate of Cabrillo College, Bethany Bible College, and San Francisco State University, where he received an MA in education. He currently works as a science writer for the U.S. Geological Survey and plays in a gypsy jazz trio. Steve's first novel, Our Lady of West 74th Street, was published in 2014, a second novel in 2017, and his third, The Saint of El Camino Real, in 2021. Steve Ackley, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Now, people might wonder, here's a science writer who puts angels on the covers of his books? That doesn't seem very scientific, Steve.
Well, I didn't start out as a science writer. Actually, I started out as an English teacher, and I went through several episodes in terms of my career. I eventually ended up in high-tech marketing for almost 30 years, and the science writing gig is sort of my, sort of my sunset job, I guess you call it. But I really enjoy what I do.
Well, why don't you describe the cover for us of this first novel that you wrote?
This is a photo. It was taken by a fellow named Emilio Guerra, who I reached out to get permission to use it. And it's a picture of Bethesda Fountain in Central Park, all covered with snow on a very quiet, what looks to me like a morning. And the trees are all highlighted in pink. It's a beautiful picture. And the story takes place in that neighborhood. So I thought it was just kind of a perfect image to use.
Yeah, well, you tell us that this statue of an angel, the sculpture, and you just describe it's a real sculpture from 1873, based on something from the Gospel of St. John. Mm-hmm. And how do you get information about angels?
Well, as you said, I in the 80s I was a student of religion, so I've read through the Bible and the New Testament. And so there's all these stories about appearances of angels. And I took it from there. There's a lot of what I'll call mythology built around angels. A lot of what I write about in the book comes from the Kabbalah, which goes into great detail about the attributes of angels. And it's just something that captivated my attention. I wrote a play, or a musical rather, when I was in college, and one of the main characters was the Archangel Michael. And so I've always had this sort of fascination, I guess, with angels.
Well, you actually begin your novel, the prelude, takes place in 42 AD. So I'm going to ask you to read what takes place in 42 AD and where.
Okay. Well, this is taken from the traditions really of the Eastern Church, actually the church as a whole, when Jesus, his life was over on earth, he went and was bequeathed the care of his mother to the Apostle John, and that Mary and John were living in Ephesus. And there is a house actually in Ephesus, which is in modern day Turkey, that is, according to the tradition, again, where Mary lived. And I based that the passage in the first part of the book about John and Mary living in Ephesus, and this is in their latter years. Well, this is kind of a fictional situation. John was a fisherman. St. John was a fisherman. And so I wrote that he continued fishing. I mean, they were living, near the sea. And so he made friends with these other expatriates from Palestine, essentially, in the town of Ephesus. And this is at the end of a day where they had finished fishing and were just relaxing. Should I start?
Yeah.
Okay. Ephesus, 42 AD. A beautiful warm day in early fall. A breeze blew in from the sea, rustling leaves in the trees. Three fishermen sat on a patch of grass in the shade, drinking wine, eating cheese, and relishing their Sabbath afternoon. Eli and Daniel were brothers whose family, decades ago, had moved from Palestine to Ephesus, where life was easier. The population was mostly Greek, and there was far less strife with the Romans. As long as they kept to their business, they were left alone. John was a more recent arrival. He had come to Ephesus with his adopted mother, Mary, 5 years ago. Mary's true son, Yeshua, had been executed by the Romans 9 years earlier for stirring political unrest. However, the real source of the irritation was religious. According to his followers, Yeshua had performed miracles and taught that he himself was divine. These were difficult teachings for the Judeans to accept. They branded Yeshua as a criminal and besought the occupying Roman army to arrest and execute him, which they did. Yeshua's dying request was that his friend John take responsibility for his mother. After the execution, John took Mary into his care, and since that time always referred to her as mother.
This is Steve Ackley reading from his first novel, Our Lady of West 74th Street, and his prelude takes us back to Ephesus in 42 AD. Now, this prelude has a title, The First Icon. So today, icon, something on your computer. So maybe you should explain why you call your preface The First Icon.
Well, icons are also paintings, typically of religious figures and religious scenes. And because the early church was largely illiterate, icons were used as teaching mechanisms for teaching people the stories of the Bible and the lives of the saints. And over time became venerated, which doesn't mean worshipped, but it means they were revered and they were an aid to people's faith. So the first icon, actually I deviate from the tradition a bit here because the first icon was attributed to St. Luke. But because John and Mary were living together in Ephesus, I had John paint this first icon. And who knows, the tradition might be wrong. Maybe there was another icon before Luke's icon. And then if you go into a church today, you'll see several icons on the walls, especially in Eastern Christian churches. So that's what an icon is. And I could go on, but that kind of summarizes it.
So you in your story, you say that John paints this portrait of Mary. And would you skip over a little bit and tell us or read what was in that painting?
Okay. So this happens in context of a vision. John's painting the icon because Mary has made some new clothes for herself and he wants to capture her. But during the painting of the icon, he falls asleep, or he starts to fall asleep, and angels come to him and provide light and tell him to finish the icon. And this is a description of the finished icon. The painting showed Mary holding her infant son, cradling him in her arm and pointing to him with her cupped right hand. Over her head, arrayed in a semicircle, were seven stars. In each of the stars, the upper body and face of a winged angel leaned forward, looking down from heaven, as if they were peering out of windows.
So here we have the description of this painting, and these seven stars are angels. And Mary says, this is a very important thing. This is how you conclude your preface. Mm-hmm. One day it will bring comfort and hope to many people. Make sure it is kept safe. So her instructions are to make sure this icon is kept safe. So your story then is really, that's the central character of your story, Steve, I think, is this icon. But there's another central character that we haven't mentioned yet. If we fast forward to, say, 1941, who is the character that you introduce us to?
This is Emily Campbell, and she's a professor of cultural anthropology at Vassar College. And she likes to focus on, in this, at least in this part of the story, she's focusing on objects that have miraculous powers, not just icons, but things like the Shroud of Turin or other relics, things that are throughout history that are attributed with miraculous powers. So she has finished giving a lecture on this very subject, and would you like me to start, or
is yeah, that because you have a scene there where she's with a friend, mm-hmm. named Martin, and he says, "I have a little trip I'm taking this Saturday into the city. Maybe you'd like be interested in coming along." So Martin or Marty is inviting this professor Emily to come along with him. Because they met when she took a summer course at Princeton, taught by this woman named Victoria. Mm-hmm. So you want to read that conversation between Emily and Marty?
Sure. Now, Martin's an older professor, so he's one of the senior professors in the department. And he's taken this fascination. He has this fascination with the paranormal, and he's actually writing a book about it. You know, different incidences of paranormal occurrences and so forth. And they're meeting in the hallway. They're both getting ready to leave the building. And Martin says, "I have a little field trip I'm taking this Saturday into the city. Perhaps you might be interested in coming along." Martin set down his old leather bag, bent over, and dug through it. Emily looked down at him and shook her head. "You know, you don't need that anymore. We have pads and scanners these days." "I'm the organic type," he said as he pawed through the bag. "Ah, here it is." He pulled out a file folder and leafed through its contents. He handed Emily a printout of a news article. "It's a daycare center on the Upper West Side," said Martin. "A couple of parents have complained that their children have reported seeing unusual things. People who aren't there, objects moving around, singing."
"Singing?"
"Yeah. When the kids were singing nursery rhymes, they heard choir voices singing along."
"Choir voices? Read the article."
So Emily reads the article, and it's about these parents that are upset because their kids are telling them all of these religious stories when they come home, and they're worried that the woman who's running the daycare center, her name is Amy, they're worried that she's trying to indoctrinate the children. Emily handed the paper back to Martin. "This is stupid. The whole thing is stupid." "I thought you were an atheist." "That has nothing to do with it. What's the point of going after a woman running a daycare center? These parents just want attention. If they don't like the place, then find another one."
"I see your point," Martin agreed. "Nevertheless, it's in our own backyard, so I thought I'd investigate. I called the woman. Mrs. Cuthbert, she's very nice. I told her I was a professor working on a book, and I'd like to get her side of the story."
"Don't make her look like an idiot, Martin." Martin organized the folder and put it back in his bag, which he then picked up and slung around his shoulder. He frowned at Emily. "You're in an unusually charitable mood, defending the daycare woman with such zeal."
"I just don't like witch huts, no matter who the witch is."
This is novelist Steve Ackley, and he is reading from his first novel in a series of three, Our Lady of West 74th Street. So we might guess, that's where Martin is going and invites Emily to go along to this place on West 74th Street. And he mentions a Mrs. Cuthbert who lives there now, but you also tell us who lived in that house before she did? Who was that?
He was a man named Klaus Bronner, and he was from Vienna, and he escaped Europe during World War II. His background was, he was an art historian, and he worked at the University of Munich, and he was part of this effort by Hitler to loot art during that time period. So he and his senior professor went to Mount Athos in Greece, and they were there essentially to kind of scope out the artworks. And then later on, Hitler or Goering, whoever it was, would come along and grab what was valuable. So he was there visiting Mount Athos, and the monks asked him, the icon that I described at the beginning was there, and the monks asked Klaus to smuggle the icon out of Europe so that Hitler's looters wouldn't get a hold of it, and he did so. And that's how he ended up in New York. And he did quite well in New York. He was he knew art, and he caught wind of the pop art movement, Jackson Pollock and de Kooning and these folks. And so he invested heavily in you know, abstract expressionism, and he made quite a bit of money and lived in this brownstone next to Central Park.
My guest is Steve Ackley, and he is author of three books. The first, Our Lady of West 74th Street. I'll be back with Steve to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Steve Ackley, who's written a trilogy about archangels. You know what I appreciated, Steve, that you did? In the back of your book, you have historical notes to tell us what was actually true, what were your inventions, but a lot of this based on something that was true. And Mount Athos was real, and I'll bet a lot of people never heard of it. And especially women may never have heard of it. And why is that, Steve?
Women are not allowed on Mount Athos. I even heard that even female animals aren't allowed. I don't know if that's true or not. So it's all men. And I don't know how many monasteries there are. It's actually a peninsula in the very northern part of the Aegean Sea. And you have to get to it by boat, though. It's not accessible by foot. And there are several monasteries there. The monastery that I picked out is Saint Panteleimon, which is a Slavic monastery. And these are all facts. And the actual trip of the Nazis to Mount Athos is true as well. There was a professor named Franz Dogler, who is a real person, who was asked to go with the Nazis out there to survey the art. And the monks, just one little thing, the monks were kind of leaning toward Hitler because they were afraid of Stalin. So there's a line in the book where I say they're running from the arms of one demon into another. So they received these Nazis and were happy to show them around.
So Mount Athos is a real mm-hmm. place.
Yes.
You have a character, Klaus Bronner, who was fictional. That was your invention. But I love the note that you added in your historical notes that in April of 2011, The TV news show 60 Minutes filmed a segment on Mount Athos where the Nazis, we told about the Nazis. But I watched that, and it was so fascinating. I think I'm going to watch it again.
It's good, yeah.
And it's accessible. I just typed in 60 Minutes, April 2011, and up came this report on Mount Athos. So thank you for including that note. I think people would really be interested. It's beautiful. Oh, my gosh. It showed film of this this monastery, the whole peninsula. It showed the buildings that you wonder, how in the world could they have made these buildings so long ago? And anyway, so thank you for including that note that we can watch a 60 Minutes report on Mount Athos. So that is real. Your character Klaus is not. Now, we have the characters to that really are, I guess you might call them characters, are icons. And you have a note in your historical notes section about miracle-working icons. Now, how is that possible, Steve?
Well, that's the question, and that's the question that's been asked throughout history. Is, you know, the whole idea of miracles, it's a matter of faith. But miracle working, there's a section of the book where I list a bunch of different miracle working icons, not only the one that's the main part of the story, and they're attributed with all kinds of things like healing and stopping wars and so forth. And a lot of times there are physical manifestations. So there are weeping icons where the actual tears run from the eyes of the Virgin. And there's myrrh-bearing icons
that was surprising too. Myrrh is a fragrance. And mm-hmm. You say that some of these miracle-working icons are reported to manifest myrrh-scented scented oil on their surfaces. I thought, well, mm-hmm. That's pleasant.
Yeah.
And people might remember that myrrh was one of the three gifts that the wise men brought at the birth of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, thank you for that little bit of information that is true in your book. So, to get back to the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
We have Emily and her daughter are having a conversation, and I would like for you to read what. Well, who is Heather, by the way?
Heather is Emily's teenage daughter. Emily's a single parent, and this the section you're referring to is they go into the city. They take this trip into the city and visit this woman, Amy, at the daycare center, while Heather and her friend go see a play.
Excuse me. Amy is the one we mentioned earlier that she had gotten in trouble because parents said, hey, what are you doing, Mrs. Cuthbert? So
yes.
Amy Cuthbert is the one that was in trouble for how she was conducting her daycare center. Okay.
Exactly.
So,
yes.
So back to Emily and her daughter, Heather.
So after they have their meeting and they regroup, so Heather and her friend and Emily and Martin all get together. And they have dinner. They're having dinner together at Ed's Chowder House, which is a real place, but I've learned it's since closed. And that's what's going on in this passage here. So this is Heather speaking. So what was it you guys were doing today? Asked Heather between spoonfuls of soup. Emily answered, we were interviewing a woman about some experiences she's had in her house. Paranormal events. Really? Said Katie. That's cool. What kind of stuff?
Katie is Heather's friend, by the way.
Yes, Katie is Heather's friend. Martin cleared his throat. Among other things, the woman maintains that she's had a visit from the Virgin Mary. She didn't say that, Martin. She just said a young woman, a girl, about the same age as you two. Emily pointed her spoon at the girls. Really? Asked Heather. I didn't know the Virgin Mary was that young. Oh, yes, Martin spoke up. According to the tradition, she was only 13 or 14 when Jesus was conceived. Wow, the girls said in chorus. And also according to the tradition, Joseph was an older man, a widower, probably around my age. Ooh, echoed the girls. Martin rolled his eyes and scowled at their response. But, inserted Emily,
Also, according to tradition, Mary was a virgin all her life. So the old man never had sex with her. She chuckled and turned her attention back to her soup. Martin smiled and shook his head. Well, as you say, it's all just tradition. No one's ever proven a thing. Why are you guys so down on religion? Asked Heather. What if there really are things we can't explain? But that's just the whole point, my dear, said Martin with a new excitement in his voice. I agree, there are things we can't explain. That's why people come up with these stories to explain things they can't understand. But what if they aren't just stories? What if they're real? To be real, there has to be proof, responded Martin. But isn't that what faith is, believing, even if there isn't proof? Asked Heather. Faith is a convention of the mind, a coping mechanism, that's all. Well, I don't agree, said Heather. But even if it is a convention of the mind, it's something that comes naturally. People have believed in God or gods as long as humans have been here. Why do you feel it's your job to pick it apart? That's pretty good, Heather, said her mother. Wow, I didn't know you thought about this stuff that much. Oh, yeah, said Katie. Some of the kids at school call her the guru.
This is Steve Ackley, Harry Stephen Ackley, reading from his novel, Our Lady of West 74th Street. I mentioned your full name because your first name is actually your dad's name, and I thought it was very sweet, the dedication of this book, Steve. Who did you dedicate this book to?
Well, I dedicated it to my parents. Their names were Harry and Lois, and they both passed away within a couple of months of each other in 2013. And so I dedicated it to their memory. And really, it was that time period in my life where it was sort of my inspiration to write it, because it was a kind of a therapeutic thing for me. And also just kind of a reckoning of my own mortality. And I thought, well, if I'm going to write, and I've always wanted to write a novel, I've written all my life, but I always wanted to write a novel, I better get to it.
In fact, you refer to yourself as a storyteller. That's how you view yourself.
I do. I don't have a huge literary background. I wasn't an English major. I haven't read the canon of Western literature or anything like that. So I don't come from that, even though I did teach English, and that's another story. I don't really come from that background. What got me interested in writing was writing for the movies. I wanted to be a screenwriter. And so I was really, the rule there is everything has to be seen and heard, because there's no narration really. It's all shown by action and dialogue. So that's what really made me want to write in the first place, to tell stories through events and through characters.
Well, angels come up in your story, obviously. And the two young girls are shocked at how young Mary was when she had Jesus. But also, when you described angels, how did you describe angels in your book, Steve? What do they look like? How do we know if we've seen an angel? Maybe we have.
Maybe we have. There's a verse by St. Paul, you know, that be kind to strangers, people have, by doing so, people have entertained angels unaware.
Yeah.
In other words, you never know. And
will you tell us there are three forms of angels?
Right. And this is all from my imagination, but it's based also on things I've read and heard. But angels can take three forms. One is being invisible. So they could be around us and we don't even know it. Another is they take human form. And this is where the stories from the Bible and other places come in, where you have Gabriel appearing to the Virgin Mary, or the angel appearing to Gideon in the Old Testament. And then the third form is when they are in the act of worshiping God, they turn into beings of light. They're visible, but they are transformed. And a good example of this would be the shepherds. In the Christmas story, the shepherds or the angels appear to the shepherds in the sky, and they're these glowing beings of light because they're singing a praise to God. And so this act of worship is what it transforms them into, this other form, this third form.
And the angels tell these shepherds, they don't tell them what to do. They don't say, go to this manger, but the shepherds are inspired to do that. I thought it was interesting what you said, angels' powers, they couldn't make humans do something, as I understood what you said. Of course, how do we know that? This is your imagination. I also wondered if you made this up, that when angels take human form, they're all exactly the same height.
I sort of made that up, but I based that on iconography, again, in the Byzantine churches, and I'm thinking specifically of the churches in Ravenna, Italy. I've never been there. It's on my bucket list. There are these depictions of angels standing in a row, and they're all the same height. They're very uniform looking. And the other thing about angels in iconography is they never have facial hair. So that's another attribute of my angels, is they don't have facial hair. In fact, and this is again taken from the stories from the Bible, they all appear typically when they're described, that they're described as young men. So they're young men without facial hair. At least that's how they appear in their human form.
Well, something else you say is that not only are they all the same height, but that they are all very tall. And mm-hmm. you say your character, Emily, converted Latin units to come out to 6 feet, 5.314 inches. Now, that is tall.
Yeah.
That's the height of angels. So if we see a really tall person with no beard and looks youthful, maybe we're looking at an angel. Now, you say that angels have other attributes. Any other attributes you want to mention of angels?
Sure. Well, this is sort of where I took a page from the Kabbalah. There's for each angel, and there are archangels listed, and the seven archangels that I list in my story are taken from a list in the Kabbalah, and they're all given different attributes. They're all associated with planets, for instance. They're associated with colors, so they have these distinct characteristics. And another characteristic that people might be familiar with is Archangel Michael, who's kind of the warrior angel. He's always shown with a sword. He's always shown stepping on a dragon. So they have these different, in addition to their physical attributes, kind of missions. They all have different missions. Gabriel is considered kind of the messenger angel because he's always, like he was the one who announced the birth of Jesus to the Virgin Mary.
And there's a song about him blowing his horn.
And so, there's lots of information out there about these different characteristics. And I borrowed some of it, and I made up some of it. And that's where I got that from.
Well, since you're mentioning angels and their attributes, you say they're immortal, but they can't know the future. But one of these, and sometimes they're visible as a person, human, and one of these shows up in Emily's class, and I'd like you to read what he has to say about the separation between science and faith. Would you read that section where this angel pretends to be a student, and he drops in on Emily's class? And can you read us that?
So, yes, Emily's giving one of her lectures, and there's this person who's auditing the class that she doesn't recognize, or at least in context of this, it comes out that he's auditing the class. And she is, again, talking about objects being imbued with supernatural power. And there is this fellow who's auditing the class. And he raises his hand. You said 78, right?
Yes. Okay. Where pretending his first name is Ron.
Right.
He says, just
yes,
call me Ron. Although we know his last name, tells us that he's one of these angels.
It's Kaseo, yes. So she says, yeah, she invites him to speak, and he says, I think the separation between science and faith is problematic. What today is thought of as science is only logical methodology. Whatever can be proven, whatever can be tested, whatever can be deduced. But that's only part of what science is. True science, and perhaps science even isn't even the right word, is the acknowledgement and appreciation of the whole, not just the parts that can be explained. We can understand what forms the clouds and causes the snow to fall. We can understand the geometry of the snow crystal. But we can also give glory to God for his beauty. Why does one have to negate the other? Emily looked out the window at the snow on the ground. She recalled her thoughts from a few days earlier. Faith is like snow. Likewise, continued Cassiel, when one encounters a seemingly unexplainable phenomenon, I believe it's fair to consider the physics behind it. Divine healing, the uncorrupted body of a saint, the appearance of the Blessed Mother. We shouldn't be afraid to put scalpel and microscope to such things.
This is novelist Steve Ackley, and he's reading from his first novel, Our Lady of West 74th Street. And this lady is this icon, and we've been talking about icons are, but also angels play a really major role in the story. And we've just heard an angel who says, just call me Ron. And earlier he claims that he's a student and he's not in the anthropology department. He says his interest is more scientific. He's interested in physics. And he says, I think there's a profound connection between science and the supernatural. And he's saying this to Emily, the professor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she describes his face. She said he had a handsome face that was strangely like a child's. And then he also says the color of his hair. He had red hair like hers, only it was kind of like the color of metal. And so this is one of these angels that are characters in your book.
Mm-hmm.
So here is he's claiming that he's a student of physics, and yet he's talking about things that most people say, oh, that's not true. This is all made up. So what do you say to people who think, oh, Steve, what are you doing writing about stuff that doesn't exist?
I had this conversation not too long ago with a couple of friends of mine, and I quoted my father, who was a judge, and he used to tell me, and we were talking about things like the supernatural, and it could be, you know, Bigfoot and UFOs. I mean, he told me, he said, you can't argue with an experience. So if somebody says they've seen something or experienced something, who are you to say they haven't?
Mm-hmm. You know what? I think it's kind of like saying, well, last night I dreamed about a polar bear, and somebody, oh, no, you didn't. How can they argue with my dream? That's something I experienced. So I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
That you don't even have to believe something. If you experienced it, it's true for you.
Sure. And, I mean, you can argue about the science and so forth and infinitum, but if someone's experience something, you can't, I mean, you can say they haven't, but I think that makes you look weak.
Steve Ackley and I will be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest has written a trilogy of books about archangels, and his name is Steve Ackley. Well, I mentioned that this is one of three books that you have written, and I also read your book, the last book you wrote, the most recent book, The Saint of El Camino Real, and what's on the cover of this book, Steve?
That is a statue. It's actually a gravestone. It's called, I think it's called the Angel of Sorrows.
Yes.
And it's...
Well, actually, you tell us it's the Angel of Grief.
The Angel of Grief. Thank you.
And it's located on the Stanford campus because that's where your third novel takes place, on the Stanford and other places, but Stanford. Mm-hmm. And so this angel is expressing grief. What do you think, though, about the gender of this angel, Steve?
Well, it could be. I'm not locked into the idea that they are all male. I have to look at the picture actually.
Well,
myself.
Yeah, because we were going to talk about your first novel, but this one, since it is an actual statue on the Stanford campus, the Angel of Grief, but it's a beautiful. This angel has wings, so that's how you know it's an angel. And the way the hair is and the way the dress is draped, it's hard to believe that all the men are, all the angels are men.
You reminded me of something as you were speaking. Yes, I actually have it right here. I have the book, and you're correct. So it's sort of a kind of a Victorian woman, or maybe Greek. She's got look like a toga almost.
Yes.
And the one of the themes throughout the three books is that angels congregate around statues of angels. So, for instance, the statue in Bethesda Fountain in Central Park is a gathering place of angels. And this is another gathering spot of angels. There's a big statue in Gateshead, England. It's a modern sculpture of an angel. There's also the statue of St. Michael, Saint Michel in Paris. So all of these places where these famous statues of angels are gathering places. And it doesn't really matter how they're rendered. The angels find it amusing.
Now you stated that like you know that angels find, you say angels find this amusing. How can you speak for angels, Steve?
Well, it goes back to being a storyteller, I guess. I think the line in the story is they find that way that humans depict them as being amusing. Mm-hmm. I think the angel at Bethesda is also a female figure as well, to be honest with you, now that I'm looking at it. So it's not so much whether they're accurate depictions, it's just that they are depictions. And they're little, like, meet-up spots for angels.
Yeah, and we usually think of women wearing flowing robes, which is mm-hmm. usually
yes,
the way
yeah, you're right.
Angels are depicted. So what do you hope people get from your books, Steve?
Well, I'm not trying to convert anybody, first of all. I guess if I do have a religious agenda, it's just to get people thinking about the topic. What they take away, what they decide for themselves is their business. But I think that it's a subject that, of course, fascinates me. I mean, I think that's clear. And I just want other people to enjoy the ride. So it's not an altar call or anything like that. It's a story. If the motive is just to put it in people's minds and enjoy the story.
Well, I mentioned that your third novel takes place on the Stanford campus, and some of your characters that we meet in your first novel, like Emily and her daughter Heather, come up in your third novel, The Saint of El Camino Real. You must surely be working on another book, Steve. Are you going to use some of these same characters?
I am working on another book. As a matter of fact, I just finished the second draft yesterday, but it is not related to the first three.
It's about the intersection of artificial intelligence and religion.
Uh-huh. Because you have one of the characters in your third book, The Saint of El Camino Real, is a robot. So we will look forward to your next book, Steve. I'll remind listeners that my guest has been Steve Ackley, his full name, Harry Stephen Ackley. He's written three books, and mainly today we talked about Our Lady of West 74th Street. He has also written The Prophet of Shattuck Avenue and The Saint of El Camino Real. So thank you, Steve.
Well, thank you very much.
Steve Ackley mentioned the Kabbalah. Chico author Glenda Lee Hoffman made an extensive study of the Kabbalah and tells us how the teachings of the Kabbalah helped her.
As a child, I was very confused about who I was supposed to believe concerning the powerful aspects of life, violence, fear, trust, and how to become not only a decent human being, but also a wise one. Then, at the age of 11, I had a full-blown mystical experience with a man who glowed with love and wisdom. He showed me in that experience that clarity is what made him so wise and loving. I suddenly realized what I wanted in that amazing moment, to see through eyes such as his. I had no idea what clarity was at that point. Nevertheless, this yearning for clarity burrowed deep within my psyche like a miracle seed, and 12 years later germinated when I encountered the Kabbalah. In my book, The Secret Dowry of Eve, I take readers on a journey through my own quest for clarity and the teachings of Kabbalah that helped me. It was during this journey that I learned to see the Garden of Eden story with much more clarity than I'd known was possible before my studies with Kabbalah. The most exciting part is that the Garden story is just as relevant today as it was when written. With my new eyes, I now see the story as taking place in the neural garden of the human brain. For, indeed, that is the only place where we will ever find the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. With this new perspective, I can see that the entire garden story takes place within the neural garden encased within our skull. It is this new perspective of an ancient story. A woman eats a fruit that opens her eyes and offers it to her husband, and he eats, and it opens his eyes too. Since this story takes place in the brain, she is not a real woman, but an archetypal figure, along with the fruit and the opening and widening of perception that allows us to see this story in a new light. Since I could now see this story as taking place in the brain, I began my own dive into modern brain research, which is where I encountered Dr. Paul MacLean and his triune brain theory. Most of us have learned to incorporate MacLean's triune brain theory into our own lives, mostly because it fits. We've been educated about evolution and accept that it is reflected in our brain, which contains the remnants of a reptilian neural substrate, an early mammalian neural substrate, and a later mammalian neural substrate. I later added a fourth phase to this model because it fit with everything I had put together. My four-part brain now contains the reptilian and mammalian neural substrates, along with a bipedal hominin neural substrate and an anatomically modern human neural substrate, the prefrontal cortex. I learned to see this and much more with my new, fully open eyes. I can now see clearly the serpent, as well as Adam and Eve, in neural form and active in my own life. And it is Eve who is the hero in this story, for it is her job as the prefrontal cortex in the human brain to slay illusions. I also see that the brain we've been gifted with has much more plasticity than most of us realize. We are not limited to be defined by others through religious or scientific theories if they offer only illusory models. We are free to investigate on our own. Gaining clarity helps us choose pathways for designing a life that invigorates us rather than depletes us. Kabbalah was my path to clarity, but I've learned there are other paths. Clarity helps you disrupt your old patterns and opens your eyes to possibilities for change. We humans are change makers. Our nature isn't to adopt a philosophy and stick to it. Our nature is to continue to change and refine ourselves. We are always becoming.
That was Glenda Lee Hoffman, author of The Secret Dowry of Eve. I would also like to thank my first guest, Steve Ackley, author of Our Lady of West 74th Street. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Only you are you. The way your lips curve into a halfway smile, like the joke's not ready. You save the punchline for dark. Only you are the tiger in my recurring dream, giant cat I taunt, run from. Only you are the one I speak to when I'm not speaking, blanket that covers me, wraps me tight until dawn, as you hike the shadowed hills, moon stepping back just for you, only you, offering a fresh sky. I'll never know where you go. Wish I could rescue you. Make us real. Make us right. Woo you from the cave where your heart hides you. Bare, unfed, not able to dig into the lighthouse of bones we both crave to suck dry. I sleep inside your mouth. Echo of your voice vibrates like music from a party in a faraway room. Can you hear it too? Only you? Kim Dower.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.